Good morning. I'm Steve Morrison, Director of the Africa Program here at CSIS, and we're really delighted that Harry Broadman has agreed to come and brief here today, this morning, on really a pretty groundbreaking piece of analytic work that he spearheaded that we'll hear more about, Africa's Silk Road, and then we'll have an opportunity to have a discussion. This is part of a broader effort that we've undertaken here in the last few months and we'll be carrying forward over the next year and beyond as a joint undertaking of the China program, China Studies program, Bates Gill and Chin Hua Hung. Bates is away this week, China, jointly with the China program and the Africa program, looking at China's expansive engagement in Africa and trying to fill in a number of really big gaps in terms of understanding of some of the trend lines and the implications, and also beginning to try and answer the questions of, well, so what, and what does this mean for U.S. foreign policy? And so we're really thrilled that Harry was prepared to come over and brief on this, and we're grateful to you for the help you provided us in briefing up the delegation that we sent out 2 weeks back to Beijing and Shanghai. Harry is a senior economic advisor to the Vice President for Africa at the World Bank. He comes with a broad background of having done extensive economic analytic work on Russia, on China. He's an academic. He's taught at Harvard and at Hopkins. So he brings quite a depth and diversified set of background experiences to this task, and we're very fortunate because he's jumped into this key domain and really helped clarify it. So thank you, Harry. And the floor is yours. Would you like people to quickly introduce themselves first?
That would be great.
Okay. Elizabeth? We'll just quickly go around.
CSIS Africa Program.
My name is Dennis Hawk. I'm with a special project at CSIS here.
My name is Bo Su, coming from Chinese branch at the Voice of America.
I'm Michael Samuels with Samuels International Associates.
Andrew Matthews, a global consultant.
Well, thank you very much for coming. What I'm going to be presenting to you today is really the highlights of this book. It's a rather lengthy book. It's about 440 pages, so I'm really just going to be summarizing the key points. There's a lot of PowerPoint slides. I'm going to be running through just some of them. They are available on the web if you want to look at them in more detail, or I'm happy to distribute them by email, whichever is easiest for you. More importantly, the book itself is actually free on the bank website for download. Of course, you can also purchase it at the World Bank bookstore. Ernie Wilson gets about 25% for every of all my sales of anything I do. This book was published in its final form about 6 weeks ago. The advance edition I presented at the annual meetings of the World Bank, IMF, in Singapore, which was our sort of appropriate launching pad for such a study. At the same time, we also convened a high-level seminar in Singapore with very senior African leaders, former presidents, African businessmen, Chinese business people, Indian business people, to sort of have a debate, a free debate. That also, that conversation is also on the World Bank website. It was quite informative. I think probably the most important point to make at the very outset of this discussion is that there's actually quite a long history of Chinese and Indian involvement in Africa. For those of you who are not familiar with that fact, you might get the sense simply reading newspaper articles or even, God forbid, foreign policy or foreign affairs articles that this has all just happened in the last 3 years. In fact, Chinese investment in trade in Africa goes back several decades, India even further. And as you'll see, the rich ethnic network, particularly of Indians in Africa, plays actually a significant role in understanding what is going on today as these trends are now really significantly accelerating. The book really just answers four questions. This is our focus. First, we wanted to document as systematically as possible just what do we know about the trends of trade and investment by Asia and Africa. Again, for those of you who are familiar with these data sources, they're quite disparate. They're not consistent. We really spent a long time trying to bring them together in one place with the objective that this is a resource for people to use. And these data are, the book was just published, so these data are usually up through 2004, 2005, because there's always a lag. But it's from my knowledge, it's sort of the most consistent database available. The second sort of objective of the book was to focus on the policy questions and to do so in a prospective, in a future prism. So we wanted to identify what are the factors that are affecting these flows, what are the determinants of these flows of trade and investment from China and India to Africa and from Africa to China and India. Because I work in the Africa program, our prism is on what is the impact on Africa. We could have written as well what is the impact on China or what is the impact on India or all three. To make my life a lot easier, and I think it was already a large chunk to digest, we decided to focus more or less strictly on the impacts on Africa. So you have to bear that in mind, that we're not focusing on these other impacts as well, which obviously do have an important policy dimension to them. And the final objective of the book was to, in light of understanding what are the determinants of these flows, what are the kinds of actions, what are the policy reforms that need to be taken by all the various stakeholders, the international community, the Chinese, the Indians, and, of course, the Africans. And when I mention the Africans, the Chinese, and the Indians, I'm not talking simply about the governments. I'm talking about the businesses, the private sector, the state sector as well. The analytical framework that we spin out is quite crucial to understanding the structure of the book and, I think, the argumentation. Basically, we're trying to test a hypothesis that to what extent do the trade and investment flows that we're observing between Asia and Africa today are influenced by traditional trade policy variables, tariffs, non-tariff barriers, quotas, and the like, as against what have been non-traditionally thought of as variables that affect trade and investment flows, behind-the-border factors. How important is the state of domestic competition in Africa's markets in determining why we're observing this variance in trade and investment flows, both across countries and across sectors? How important are differentials in the state of governance among African countries in determining why we're observing these differences? The second non-traditional trade policy or investment policy variable that we look at are what I call the between-the-border factors, or the elements that give rise to transactions cost for cross-border transactions or cross-border flows of investment and trade. So how important is the differences in logistics, in trade facilitation infrastructure, and institutions that govern those infrastructures? And then finally, what I think is probably the most important and I think innovative aspect to the analysis is it really reasonable to think about trade and investment as separate items and understanding why we're observing the variance that we're observing? And in fact, we test the hypothesis to what extent are there complementarities between foreign direct investment coming into Africa from China and India and trade flows. And we have in this part of the analysis sort of a three-part model looking at to what extent are the Chinese and Indian firms investing in Africa, doing so to sell the output either locally within the local African market in which the plant is established or elsewhere in Africa, a pan-African integration. Secondly, to what extent, and this varies by sector obviously, is the output being produced in the local African economy then exported back to the home market? And then thirdly, to what extent is the output or the services produced in the local African economy actually exported to third parties? Let me tell you, I think what at the outset, what are the sort of main headlines or conclusions from the study, just because from my experience doing this for many years, is that humans usually take away about four or five things. So I'm going to expand the horizon and give you six conclusions so you'll remember at least what it is that the book has said. The first is that this quote, newfound, unquote, interest by China and India in Africa actually represents a significant opportunity for Africa, perhaps a second opportunity for Africa. Second in the sense that this rise in trade flows and investment flows by China and India to Africa is part of this South-South trade and investment that's begun to emerge. The traditional trade flows and investment flows have been North-South. Today, South-South trade flows worldwide cover roughly about 11%, 12% of world trade. This Chinese and Indian trade and investment really, to my mind, epitomizes this new trend in South-South trade and investment. To what extent does this represent a significant opportunity for Africa? Our answer is yes, if certain things are done. The second major finding of the book is that the activities by Chinese and Indian firms in Africa that we looked at the firm level cover much more than natural resources. In fact, if you just read the newspapers, you would get the impression, A, that China and India have only recently discovered Africa, and B, that it's basically oil, oil, oil. In fact, there is, I think, in the last 4 or 5 years, a significant acceleration and diversification in the types of investments, the types of trade activities that are taking place in Africa by Chinese and Indian firms. And in fact, the way that we conducted the core of this analysis was to look at firm-level data, which I'll mention in a second in more detail, outside of the oil sector. We deliberately focused on four countries and carried out a firm-level survey and did not cover the petroleum sector. Why is that? Well, from a public policy point of view, it's relatively well understood, although difficult to implement, what are the rules of the game, what are the kinds of desirable ways forward in terms of dealing with oil resources, whether from a Dutch disease problem, a governance problem, and the like. Secondly, we wanted to test this hypothesis about to what extent is there actually significant activity taking place outside of the oil sector. The data would be swamped if we had included oil sector, and which just would have made the analysis much more difficult. The third major finding of this book is that the typical Chinese and Indian firms that we looked at in many of the sectors, though not all, and in many of the countries, though not all, are quite sophisticated firms. These are multinationals in some senses that rival multinationals from the north, from the OECD countries. This is, again, something that most people do not understand I certainly was a little bit surprised, even as an expert in Chinese enterprises, by the sophistication of some of the Chinese and some of the Indian firms that are extremely active, increasingly so, in Africa. And as a result of their sophisticated corporate strategies, reflected perhaps most visibly in their integrated structures, they're part of group companies, they are having an effect on trade and investment patterns for Africa that are affecting the extent to which there's integration by African firms in both the world economy and, perhaps most importantly and more surprising, regionally. And you'll see that the data that we have collected show that relative to African cohorts in the same sector in the same country, Chinese and Indian firms tend to be far more regionally integrated within Africa than these African cohorts are, and that's an important finding. The fourth, fifth, and sixth headline of the book have to do with the policy issues. As I said, this represents perhaps an important second opportunity if certain things happen. What we focus on is the fact that, you know, there are indeed significant asymmetries between China and India on the one hand and Africa on the other. One example is if you look at the scale of African exports to Asia, today they're roughly on par with African exports to the EU and the United States, about 27-30%. The African exports to the European Union have declined by about 50% in the last decade. That's a startling change. But the asymmetry arises when you look at the Asian perspective. For the Asian countries, of all their global imports coming in, Africa's share of that represents less than 2%. So there's a huge disparity, and this is just one example among many that we describe in the book that gives rise for the need for policy actions to deal with these opportunities in such a way that Africa can maximize the benefits and minimize the costs. As part of this discussion of what are the policy actions, we put together sort of a division of labor, if you will, as to who needs to do what from our diagnosis in terms of what do the international donors need to do, what do the Chinese and Indian leadership and businesses need to do, and what do the African leaders and businesses to do. The lion's share of the reform actions that have to take place fall on the side of the Africans, the African leadership. From our analysis, it's leadership in Africa that is probably the scarcest commodity, and there's pretty much an absence of the logic of collective action to actually exploit this newfound interest in Africa by China and India, and by harnessing these kinds of actions that we talk about through collective action, in fact, these opportunities can be realized and minimize the cost therefrom. And as part of this set of policy actions as to why the bulk of them fall on the Africans is that the trade policy variables that we focus on as part of this analytical framework turn out to be, perhaps not surprisingly to some of you, relatively insignificant relative to the behind-the-border factors, the between-the-border factors, these complementarities between trade and investment flows. To speak as an economist, the trade policy variables are necessary, but they're not sufficient in explaining the variance that we're observing across sectors, across countries. In part, that's intuitive because for most African countries, for China and India, they're members of the WTO. Their tariffs are comparatively low. Yes, there are serious tariff problems, which I'll mention in a minute. There are some serious non-tariff barriers. But relatively speaking, trade policy has been liberalized. Where there has been the problem is on the behind-the-border issues and on the between-the-border issues. And this gives rise in our econometric work and case study work as to why we're observing these kinds of differences and patterns. Just a quick word on the data, since I've alluded to it. Beyond using official statistics at the aggregate level, which, as I said, are very difficult to come by in a consistent manner, we created two different databases. The first was a firm-level survey covering 450 firms operating currently in Africa that have varying degrees of Chinese and Indian ownership, affiliation, subcontracting interest, variations thereof. as well as control groups of African firms, U.S. firms, European firms, other foreign investors. So that's the quantitative database. And this firm-level survey was carried out in the four countries that I mentioned, the non-oil countries, and they are South Africa, Tanzania, Senegal, and Ghana, all countries that have varying degrees of Chinese and Indian investment and trade activity. The second part of the database that we put together was qualitative in nature. These business case studies that we developed for 16 firms that were not covered by the survey. I spent about a day with each of these 16 CEOs, again, of varying degrees of Chinese and Indian ownership, shareholding interest in Africa. From my experience working in China, from working in Russia and the Balkans, only when you marry these quantitative data with qualitative data, on-the-ground data, do you really get a full picture of what is going on. Admittedly, we're not covering all the 47 sub-Saharan countries. We're looking at 450 firms, but we're getting a reasonable approximation for what's going on, I believe, in the non-oil economy, save for the fact that we're not looking at some landlocked countries, but I'll talk about that in a second. Just a few points before I get into to the detailed data. The first point, I think, for those of you who are not familiar with Africa, but it's important to understand Africa's context in the world economy because this is the way the Chinese and Indians see it, is that Africa is an increasingly diverse economy from economic performance point of view. More than a third of the population in Africa today live in countries where economic growth, per capita GDP growth, has been at least 4.5% for a decade. Is 4.5% enough? Absolutely not. I mean, we need something on the order of probably 7, 8, 9% for a decade. But there's a pack of countries that have broken out, and these are the non-oil countries to boot. This is important from an investment and trade point of view because it means that, A, there is heterogeneity in the continent, and so Africa is becoming more like a, quote, normal, unquote, continent with this kind of heterogeneity. But from a public policy point of view, it's also important because it means that there can be success stories in Africa and that the laggards on the continent perhaps can learn from what happened in Africa as to why these countries, these non-oil countries, actually, some of which are landlocked, some of which are, or many of which are resource poor, have actually been able to grow substantially. So this is an important context to recognize that clearly Africa, like any other continent, is not monolithic, but what's really different about Africa is that if you looked at this picture 10 years ago, you would see uniformly low growth rates. You'd see a couple of stars, Cote d'Ivoire, South Africa, a couple more, and that's it. Today we're seeing a much more diverse economy with growth. That's the good news. The bad news is that the continent is mired in a secular decline in its share of world exports, and this is why the interest by China and India, among others, in Africa is important if the opportunities can be harnessed so that this trend can begin to be reversed. The other important point I think to make when thinking about China and India, which we discuss in some detail in the book, is obviously their role as emerging economic giants as part of the South-South trade and investment rise. Their demand created by their growth for commodities obviously has been playing a significant role for Africa, but it's been playing a significant role for Africa in terms of improving its terms of trade, not just in oil, but in other commodities as well. Again, the story is that there's a much more diversified picture that's going on in Africa as a result of Chinese and Indian investment than simply the oil sector. When we go one level down and look at the sort of country-by-country statistics in Africa, what one sees is actually not just that there has been an increase in trade and investment flows by Asia with Africa, but in the last 5 years there's actually been an acceleration. That is to say, the rate of increase itself has increased, hence why you're seeing this dramatic decline in African exports destined for the European Union. Let me talk now for a few minutes about these four elements of the analysis. One of the things that a trade economist like to do, or maybe not like to do, but do nonetheless, is carry out what are called gravity model analyses. We try to estimate what are the determinants of bilateral trade flows on a country-by-country basis and gauge to what extent these trade flows, the variance in trade flows, are affected by different types of variables. There's a huge literature, there's a huge debate about the wisdom of doing such models. We don't put a lot of credence in the particular model that we've chosen, but the results are relatively robust. And the robust results suggest, as I mentioned as part of the sort of major headlines of the book, is that generally trade policy plays only a necessary role but not a sufficient role, and that when you look at how effective our customs administration, how important is the state of governance, how important is the state of competition, you see that those variables tend to be much more significant, or at least as significant, as the trade policy variables are in understanding why a certain African country is garnering more foreign investment or more trade than another. So this is sort of sets the stage for our in-depth analysis of these four particular parts of the policy mix. With respect to the at the border or the trade policy variables, I'm just going to mention two that are the most provocative. We have a whole chapter on this, but I'm just going to mention two. As I mentioned, tariff levels generally have come down worldwide and certainly among many African countries and largely China and India. But what is particularly pernicious is the fact that for some of Africa's leading exports, there are escalating tariffs in India's and to a lesser extent Chinese markets. Escalating in the sense that as a commodity or a product is processed further and further, representing more value added, the tariff rate actually rises. And this table illustrates some examples from our analysis of these escalating tariffs. So to give you a very concrete example, I spent a day with a Tanzanian cashew nut producer, fourth generation Indian, outside of Dar es Salaam. He raises cashew and produces cashew nuts. When he sells raw cashews to India, he can do so quite profitably because the tariff rate on imports of raw cashews into India is relatively low. When he processes the cashew nuts and tries to sell them to India, he cannot do it profitably at all and doesn't even attempt it. This is because the tariffs on processed cashews are quite high in India. India happens to be the largest cashew nut producer in the world. There's a story behind that, but the fact is that today they are the largest cashew nut producer in the world, and they are practicing plain old protectionism. It's a particularly poignant story from our standpoint because here you have South-South trade going on, and you have developing countries actually acting just as the North has and as were criticized by their southern partners for many, many years. The policy implications are quite clear. China, too, also has escalating tariffs. I was just illustrating the example from India. When you look at the sort of most provocative issue that rises on the trade policy side, on the African side, one of the major issues for trade in Africa as a result of the fact that this is a continent populated by a large number of small countries that are landlocked, regional integration is pretty much the only way forward for most of these countries to grow through trade. Their markets are small, so they're not able to have economies of scale, economies of scope, and basically develop export platforms. One of the principal ways to date that the African leadership have focused on fostering regional integration is through fashioning regional trade agreements. This picture of the classic economist spaghetti bowl of regional trade agreements in Africa is not terribly different from what you would see with a similar diagram with the former Soviet Union or the Balkans. What is striking from our survey and from our business case study data is that the Chinese and Indian investors, as well as the European and U.S., and indeed the African investors and traders, tell us that these trade agreements mean very little to them. They're certainly not fostering their business decisions to take place in certain locales. And if anything, in some cases, they're quite confusing, understanding the various rules of origin and so forth. Fortunately, most of these regional trade agreements are still on paper and haven't been implemented. But there's a political motive, obviously, as to why these regional trade agreements exist. Again, the policy conclusion from our standpoint is relatively straightforward. That is to reduce the number, consolidate, and harmonize these regional trade agreements, such as we've been doing, we meaning the World Bank, and others have been doing in the Balkans in terms of creating more unified free trade areas. Imagine that rather than this picture, you had an African continent comprised of two or three free trade areas. It would be a very different picture in terms of fostering trade and investment. So that's the two trade policy variables I wanted to just mention as somewhat provocative. Now let's step back from beyond the trade policy factors and look at first the behind the border factors. One of the elements that continues to come up in this book, as from other World Bank and other analyses, about what are the most important pernicious behind the border barriers to trade and investment in Africa is the quality of infrastructure services, and in particular, electric power. And what we're seeing is that the poor reliability, poor quality of electric power, time and time again, registers as the most significant barrier to exports in Africa. It also hurts, obviously, domestic production, but it certainly is hurting exports. The other major issue that we looked at is this sense of domestic competition. When you look at the typical African market, you'll see that, depending on which sector you're looking at, that most of the incumbent firms have relatively high market shares. That is to say, there is, all other things equal, some ability to exercise market power. The question is, to what extent, when we're looking at Chinese and Indian investment or other foreign investors, to what extent is new entry in these markets actually driving down market shares? To what extent, as economic theory would suggest, when you have new entry, whether it's domestic or foreign, are things being stirred up and competition taking hold? This picture is simply illustrative. It's not an econometric exercise, but it's showing that there seems to be some kind of trend that in markets where there's greater Chinese and Indian foreign investment, new foreign investment, the average market share tends to be lower. And we have other data in the book that sort of corroborates this type of hypothesis. When we look at the between-the-border impediments, a couple of things, again, are very important. The first is the time it takes to get goods to the border, to the ports, the cost it takes in Africa to get the goods and the products to the ports or the borders are enormously high. And these are significant contributors to what I would call economic frictions or high transactions costs. And again, Chinese and Indian firms clearly find that this is a huge issue. I mean, we have lots of facts in the book that show that it's much cheaper actually to ship a container from Kinshasa to Shanghai than it is, within Africa itself. And this was not heard from just one Chinese firm, but several. Another issue that gives rise to high transactions costs between the border is the lack of information about market opportunities, an imperfect market for information, if you will. One of the ways that firms around the world get around such market imperfections is through informal channels, since formal information is often not available, particularly in a developing world such as Africa. What we found is that, not surprisingly perhaps, Indian firms are much more integrated as a result of their long ethnic history in Africa than are the Chinese firms in Africa. They're much more integrated into the African economy, the socioeconomic fabric. This is the kind of stuff that comes not only from the survey, but from the business case studies. And what you see here is one illustration of this difference. the typical Indian firm that we surveyed, the manager of the firm, although being of Indian ethnicity, takes on an African nationality. You don't see that correspondence yet with the Chinese owners. In fact, there were two CEOs of Indian firms in Africa who said that we do not want to be known as Indian firms. We actually proactively take action so that we are known as an African firm. One does not hear that from the Chinese firms that we at least have been dealing with in this research. Now, lastly, on the analysis of this relationship between trade and investment, clearly in the natural resource of the oil sector, you would expect some kind of strong correspondence. Remember this model I explained to you, one of these three models of putting a plant, putting a production facility in Africa, and exporting the product back home. Classic case would be oil. So there you have foreign direct investment coming in, exports coming out, hence a positive association. So you see, when you look at the data, again, this is not a serious econometric exercise, but rather illustrative, again, you see a positive relationship, some kind of complementarity between trade and investment. We were interested in to find out to what extent is this relationship also occurring or at least beginning to occur in some semblance outside of the oil sector. Our business case study certainly found strong evidence for this. The data are showing some, by dint of this, the second line in the graph, showing some evidence of this complementarity taking hold. And again, it varies by sector. I mentioned that one of the ways in which the complementarity between trade and investment for Chinese and Indian firms is being played out in Africa is by dint of the fact that these firms have integrated or group company structures. As those of you who know either Chinese or Indian firms well know that the typical Chinese large industrial firm is state-owned. Indian firms are not generally state-owned, but still group companies. And you see from this kind of table that the typical firm that we surveyed, in fact, does match this kind of profile with the Chinese firms actually having a much more extensive group company structure, at least among those that we surveyed, relative to the Indian firms. And this has implications. The first is, as I mentioned, the degree of regional integration within these integrated structures. When you look at to what extent African firms in a local African market are selling their output in regional markets also on the continent, you see that they are not as successful in penetrating regional African markets as are the Chinese or the Indian firms. This speaks to what I mentioned in the beginning, that in terms of horizontal integration on the African continent, it seems to be the case, again, among the firms that we surveyed, that the Chinese and Indian firms are engaged in much greater regional integration by dint of their integrated corporate strategies, greater sophistication, engaging in network trade, and the like. The same holds when that was horizontal integration. When one looks at vertical integration, you see, again, a very similar pattern, except here, again, there are major differences between the typical in quotes, Chinese firm investing in Africa and the typical Indian firm investing in Africa. Here, you see that the Chinese firms are far more vertically integrated in this particular dimension, which is the procurement of new machinery. Other slides are more generalized, but this is perhaps most striking. 60% of the new machinery acquired by the average Chinese firm that we surveyed is procuring that machinery in China. Whereas for the Indians, the typical Indian firm surveyed is procuring only 22% of its new machinery back in India. So it's engaging much more in the open market, if you will, for transactions than through intra-corporate transactions. What's the hypothesis here? The hypothesis here is that Chinese firms are more risk-averse in their corporate strategies in Africa than are the Indian firms. Is that intuitive? I think so. It's intuitive because it is consistent with the finding that Indian firms, Indian owners, or at least, are more integrated into the African economy, as I showed earlier. It's also intuitive just from the history of India's involvement in Africa. And the Chinese are relatively newer to Africa and are stepping more gingerly in some sense, or are much more risk averse. Again, the same pattern emerges when you look at more generally material input purchases, another dimension of vertical integration. You see that the typical Chinese firm is buying, in general, you know, more than 55% of its input from China, whereas a typical Indian firm is only procuring about 28% within India. The last slide on this interaction between investment and trade comes through: to what extent are these integrated structures resulting in climbing the value chain? Presumably, if you know these firms are engaging in network trade and integration for profitable reasons, one should begin to see differences in the way that they're extracting value. And if you look at the bottom column where it says, bottom row where it says export sales outside of Africa, it's one example that I think makes it quite clear. Here, the typical African firm that we surveyed is still exporting 13% of its exports in the form of raw material. The Chinese and Indian firms and European firms are not exporting from Africa things in the raw material state. They're climbing the value chain. That's good. I mean, they're extracting value on the African continent, again, by dint of the fact that they have integrated corporate structures and they're able to engage, you know, in network trade much more so than the African firms. Now, the implications of this, as I say, are good because it's creating more value on the African continent. The other implication is that through the business case studies, we found that the African firms are beginning to partner now with some Chinese and Indian firms. And they're beginning to partner not only to climb this value chain, they're beginning to partner in order to take advantage of this regional or horizontal integration that I've mentioned before. Let me just close quickly with sort of the policy implications and then open it up for a discussion. I think in terms of trade policy, the two major points I would make are the need to deal with these escalating tariffs and deal with, in part, the market access problem that China and India are posing to African exporters. And from the African standpoint, beginning to deal with regional integration in a much more serious way, not necessarily through this hodgepodge of regional trade agreements, but through the behind-the-border kinds of reforms, which I'll mention in a second. But one intermediate step towards that goal is to reduce the number, consolidate, to harmonize the number of the regional trade agreements. Now, a very important point needs to be made about these escalating tariffs and this market access question, which has received a lot of attention. I think you know, there's a reasonable hypothesis that even if these tariffs were to go to zero, it's not obvious that the African firms would be able to actually take advantage of these export opportunities. And I think that's where we get into this analysis about how important is trade policy variables as opposed to or complementary to the behind-the-border types of reforms that are necessary. So in terms of the behind-the-border policy discussions that we have in the various chapters, we focus on three major issues. One is to improve governance. Governance in the sense of creating checks and balances, greater transparency and accountability, not only public sector governance, but also corporate governance. Secondly, is taking steps to improve domestic competition within African markets. Why is that important? Because as you see region after region around the world, where you have firms that are more competitive domestically, these are going to be the firms that are going to be more competitive internationally. Success at home breeds success abroad. And so we have a series of recommendations about how to foster greater competition domestically as part of the process of exploiting the interests that China and India have in Africa. And the third point element in the behind the border policy agenda is creating greater flexibility in factor markets, in the markets for capital, in the markets for workers in Africa. Why is this important? Well, again, it's fine to liberalize on the trade side, but unless you can relieve the pressure not only on the product market through competition, which I've just spoken about, You also need to do it on the factor market. And the lesson from the former Soviet Union is quite telling. When the former Soviet Union dismantled in the early 1990s, virtually most of the countries almost immediately reduced their tariffs. Imports came in. And in some cases, actually, poverty was exacerbated. Two types of countries then emerged, even more or less to this day. One are the countries who did very little behind the border, either in terms of product competition, stimulating product competition, or more importantly, creating more flexibility for workers to move, for firms to close and to reorganize to sectors where there's more value added. Those are the Central Asian republics. Those are the Belaruses. Those are the countries who liberalized on the import side but did very little behind the border. The Polands, the Czechs, the Hungaries, the Baltics are the economies who not only liberalized on the trade side but also did the behind-the-border types of reforms. And these are the economies who not only have been growing but have reached relatively high levels of GDP. The lessons are quite applicable here to Africa, thinking about how to deal with the challenge and the opportunities posed by China and India. On the between-the-border reforms, the discussion focuses on how to improve customs administration, again, which really rose quite highly in our discussions with the Chinese and Indian firms, how to improve and build infrastructure, trade facilitation infrastructure, which actually the Chinese are actually engaging in constructing quite significantly. And the between-the-border reforms also relate to the policies that guide the use of those infrastructures. It's one thing to build a road or a port or freight forwarding services. It's quite another to make sure that the tariffs charged for the use of those facilities are market-oriented. And finally, with respect to the relationships between trade and investment in order to exploit those complementarities, if you believe that there is a complementary relationship, it means that one needs to focus clearly on improving the domestic investment climate for domestic investors. That's first and foremost. I mean, if we can get African investors investing in Africa, all the foreign investment in the world will come. But as a complement to that, in order to jumpstart the process and allow Africa to get involved much more quickly into network trade, it's going to mean creating an environment for foreign direct investment to entice sophisticated multinationals. And this clearly, you know, revolves back to the between-the-border agenda, the behind-the-border agenda. You have to put all these things together, plus specific policies that are germane to attracting foreign direct investment. Finally, this division of labor. And I think it's important to sort of figure out who needs to do what. We accent in this analysis the need for the international community to do certain things in terms of technical assistance, in terms of helping improve technical standards, harmonizing these regional trade agreements, competition, governance, and so forth. That's what we see as our major role. And then the question becomes, well, what do the Chinese and the Indians need to do? And again, thinking about the market access question, clearly, there is the burden they need to bear about resolving and reforming these escalating tariffs, but also dealing with their own behind-the-border barriers to exports and investment by African firms investing and trading in China and India. But the lion's share of the reforms, as I said, are the behind-the-border reforms, and this necessarily, by definition, falls into the plate of the Africans. And so here the agenda, unfortunately or fortunately, is the largest, and it means that the African leadership now has to step up to the plate and take on these kinds of domestic reforms that, while not necessarily thought of as reforms that will engender trade and investment or harness the benefits therefrom, but they clearly are. So let me stop there and take questions and comments. I covered you know, a lot of ground. I understand that. A lot of technical stuff I glossed over, but I'm happy to engage in more detailed discussion of anything.
Why don't we open for a number of comments? We'll bundle together a number of comments and questions and then come back to you. One thing we heard a lot about in Beijing and Shanghai recently from both officials folks as well as business sector folks and academics is this rising concern around the reputational risks that the Chinese business sector poses. And this sense that this is a large, diverse, growing community, and it's one that falls outside of the sort of policy direction and the domain of the government. And how do you reach that dispersed hundreds of thousands of different firms that are coming at their opportunities with quite variable approaches and causing heartburn in many different places? Because if there are corrupt practices or otherwise really difficult problems emerge from their engagement, then there's an immediate – within the media, there's this immediate pullback to, well, this is part of a broader officially sanctioned expansion of Chinese engagement, when in fact it may not be. But it gets to one front-edge image and media-saturated issue now coming from the sort of Chinese side that they're puzzling over. And that's – I was surprised at the strength and consistency with which we heard about that issue. So I was hoping you could offer us some insight into that. It's a bit – it relates directly in some ways to what you're talking about, but is looking beyond that. The second – piece would be what comes next in the kind of research agenda. In other words, this is a terrific piece of work that opens a number of windows for us in thinking in a very constructive and very systematic way about what this means, and it changes the way we think. What would the next phase of a research agenda that would follow on this look like? Let's also open and take several comments. Jennifer and David, then we'll come over here. We'll have a couple of different rounds. We've got another 30 minutes or so.
Just to follow up on the corrupt.
I was wondering if there was a particular focus of attention on specific countries in the Indian case with the Indian diaspora and perhaps the petroleum sector countries, and with the Chinese, are they focusing primarily on petroleum countries and resource-rich countries, or is it a general involvement with the whole continent? Are there particular centers of investment?
I'd be interested in your comment on two external activities that seem to affect the environment that you've studied. The first is the now annual doing business indicator activities of the World Bank and its impact and identification of behaviors that may be relevant to the kinds of things you observed? And secondly, the fact that in the Doha negotiations of the WTO, it appears as if most African countries have been given a free ride by not having to make many changes either at the border or behind the border in order to kind of buy their participation. Is that good or bad for the environment that you've studied?
Question about Chinese firms. Did you notice a difference in behavior or motivations or constraints between SOEs and private firms? And also in the press, you often see complaints about Chinese firms using only Chinese labor and not hiring Africans. Could you comment on the pervasiveness of that or how it plays out?
Those are really easy questions. Thanks. Ernie, do you want to take most of these? I mean, the question of that you posed, Steve, about reputational risk by firms is actually a very, very interesting one and something that in part has to be analyzed in thinking about the reputational risk on the part of the government as well. I mean, it's hard to separate reputational risk that the firms, the Chinese firms, think about and the government faces, you know, in large part because at this juncture, most of the large firms, most of the significant investments in China, most of the significant Chinese investment firms in Africa are state-owned. And so to think that there is a separation of government from business, I think is probably not, completely an accurate picture. Now, having said that, in part to answer one of the other questions, you do see a difference between the strategies, both reputational risk strategies and competitive strategies, between the non-SOEs Chinese firms that are present in Africa and the state-owned firms. One of the biggest differences, of course, is manifest in the differences in scale. I mean, typically the private Chinese firm that's investing in Africa is very small, small in the sense of maybe 5, 10, 20 employees. But they're still relatively small in number in terms of the population, in terms of the value of investments. It's still dwarfed by the state-owned enterprises. And the private firms are much more willing, again, this is sort of not surprising, are much more willing to bear risk than are the state-owned firms. Again, because they're coupled with the government back in Beijing or their particular provinces. Having said that, I think from the government point of view, there is, at least from our discussions with the Chinese, an increasing attention to reputational risk. I mean, in fact, those are the words that they actually use, and they are concerned. I think before you guys left, I sent over, and you probably other people have seen these 9 principles that the government has issued. Whether they will actually have traction is another matter. But it to me, knowing China as I do, was reflective of obviously a thought process that's going on, and obviously some nerve has been touched. I also think that I think what many of us tend to forget is that China is a developing country, and they're still very much going through an evolutionary process themselves. And so, in some sense, this is something new, in quotes, to them, to both from the firm standpoint and from the government standpoint, to sort of have this pushback and outside of their own sort of territory, if you will, and outside the northern export markets in the U.S. and the EU. And now it's happening in Africa. There's obviously a foreign policy overlay, a national security overlay, which I think, again, to think that these are not bundled somehow would not be the accurate picture. For obviously, our analysis focuses on the economics of it. We obviously don't get into the foreign policy issues. I'll come back to the research agenda question in a second. Are the Chinese more willing to engage in discretionary or opportunistic behaviors, as I'll rephrase it. Far be it for a U.S. citizen to say that certain firms are more willing to engage in discretionary behavior than firms of our own national flag. But I think the important point to make is that these are largely state-owned firms and have deeper pockets almost by definition than either their African counterparts, the typical U.S. or European, more so in contrast to the typical U.S. firm. And as a result, they're willing to engage in certain practices that they're able to do so, you know, without bearing a bottom line loss than their U.S. counterparts are. And I'll give you an example. In terms of public procurement projects, construction projects, something in the order of 8 to 9 out of 10 projects are won by Chinese firms. And it's so much the case that I've had at least 2 different African construction firms tell me we're no longer bidding against the Chinese. This is African bidding against the Chinese in their own home governments for construction projects. Clearly, you know, it would be naive to think that there's not subsidization, you know, going on. But one of the things that's happening is that the African firms, again, are beginning to partner with the Chinese firms and going into these contracts, these bids, as joint ventures. And in fact, one of the Indian firms I spent a day with in Ghana said, you know, literally, if you can't beat them, join them. And you know, I guess, you know, there's plus sides and minus sides to that. Are the Chinese firms more patient? I think, again, I think this is part of the larger picture of South-South trade and investment and why this is so intriguing to many of us looking at economic transactions among developing countries. To what extent are these transactions unique? I have a very open mind about that, frankly. But if there is uniqueness about it, is that developing countries have a really good sense of what it means to engage in an investment in a developing country. And so you do find, on average, a much longer time horizon. But again, going back to this question of state enterprise versus private enterprise, as you would expect, there are different time horizons and different attitudes towards risk-bearing patience between private and state-owned enterprises. It's very, in terms of the question about where China goes on average and where Indian investors go, it's very difficult to summarize. But if you look at the numbers by value, in part because to sink an oil well or a production field, by definition, is a large amount of money, and China happens to have at this juncture more oil investments in Africa than the Indians do, you know, statistically, the Chinese are investing much, from a foreign direct investment point of view, far more in the oil sector than are the Indians, by value. But then when you look at by number, you get a very different picture. What also has, I think, begun to change is that while India has had generally a more diversified portfolio in their investments and trade in Africa, again, by dint of the fact that they've had a longer history there, what we are finding, and I think what is novel in this book, is that the Chinese, again, you wouldn't get this from the newspapers, are also rapidly diversifying, whether it's in telecom sector, whether it's in water services, whether it's in food processing, horticulture. We have lots of examples in this book. On this question about, to paraphrase the question, does doing business matter? Yes and no. I mean, I think, and I probably have a somewhat cynical view of this, having worked on similar types of things in Russia. It certainly has caught attention on the part of the leadership that when they see country, my country X is rated, number so and so relative to that, it's sort of, a bad press day. But I think there's also some degree of cynicism about, how important are and how accurate are these measures in getting to the underlying fabric of the microeconomy. So within that context, do these kinds of indicators actually motivate reform? you know, probably on the margin they do. But I also think it would be naive to think that, you know, political vested interests don't hold far greater sway than the impact of, you know, what the World Bank or what, you know, any other third party says about, you know, various rankings. I mean, to be cute about it, have the rankings of Transparency International, you know, engender differences in outcomes of corruption. It's a rhetorical question, not a terribly serious one. On the Doha round, I mean, I think that's a difficult question about this free rider issue. You know, it's quite conceivable, I think, from my perspective, that is, you know, a serious part of the problem. And I think without second guessing the negotiating strategy, you know, I'm sure that. Maybe I'm sure that if they had to do it all over again, there might be a different agenda on the table, and different types of homework would have been done, I think, to deal with that. And then on this labor question, I should have mentioned it because there is one slide actually on this. Again, if you read the newspapers, you get this feeling that China or India. But China seems to grab more attention these days, is a monolith, and that they come to Africa as a package. Again, you know, that's just really naive. I mean, there is clearly heterogeneity across sectors. It depends on which country. I have seen, you know, several examples, whether it's in the construction industry, whether it's in the textile and apparel industry, where, you know, the number of Chinese workers are very minimal. And just basically the senior level managers, and the vast bulk, 95% of the workforce are Africans. But I've also seen the reverse. And I think, you know, one of the biggest mistakes that we make, and one of the reasons that motivated this book, was to try to figure out, well, you know, the world is certainly gray, and what's going on the ground. And, you know, lo and behold, the Chinese are sort of behaving as, you know, as corporates, not terribly differently than other corporates are. And, you know, it's which people may not want to hear that, but, you know, it's just the case. And so while on average, certainly, you know, China has, you know, a labor surplus and relatively cheap labor and in some cases, therefore, engages in more labor intensive types of sectors than do the Indians, I'm not sure that, you know, one can say across the board that there's labor displacement. Does it happen? Absolutely. But does it happen by U.S. and European investors coming to Africa? Absolutely. So I just think it's really important to keep in mind what the counterfactual is when one makes these kinds of conclusions and judgments, without trying to be an apologist for China at all. And if any of you have read anything that I've written on China, you know I'm hardly an apologist for China. I want to come back to you in the research question, okay. as I think about it.
This is really very, very interesting, and I think it sheds a lot of light. I've got two questions. The first one is related to the issue of reputation. It's kind of from the other side. A lot of Western OECD-type companies are involved in one way or another in corporate social responsibility, community outreach kinds of programs. And one of the complaints that I have heard is that they don't believe that Chinese companies and, to a lesser extent, Indian companies are similarly involved. Wanted to know whether your research bears that out, whether it's, you know, I know it's not necessarily something that you focused on specifically, but what's your anecdotal sense of that? And do you see that as something that is moving over the course of time, number one? And the second thing is related specifically to new technologies that are coming in. We've seen a tremendous amount of change, you know, cell phones, WiMAX, all kinds of new technologies that are going to help, theoretically, the continent skip steps. And I'm interested, I know that India is very involved in this kind of thing, and so is China to a great extent. Have you seen them starting to move in that direction as well?
60% of what I wanted to ask. So I wanted to talk about the opening of the services sector to the extent that there is liberalization in the services sector. You know, we find constantly that the lesser developed countries bind together on restricting liberalization of the service sector, yet that continues to mire them in inefficiency and poverty. And until they're able to get the same efficiency tools that the more developing countries in the form of telecommunications, banking, and other instruments, then they're still going to be a very much of a ceiling as to where they're going to be able to grow or how they're going to be able to grow. So that's just a comment. And I also think that some of the regional extension of these firms, having worked with some of these firms, is a way they don't necessarily have to assume the same currency exchange risks by going regional. They can do a lot of intra-firm exchanges, and therefore they can avoid some of the currency exposures that other domestic firms get. And then thirdly is the notion that Andrew sort of touched upon, but at what point do the Chinese, who particularly, I don't mean to avoid the Indians, but since Steve and I were just coming back from China, I think that's been the focus of our concentration. At what point do people start complaining a lot about China's willing to facilitate investment in Africa to get our access and to facilitate trade? What I'm talking about is subsidization of investment. We've been hearing over and over again about the willingness of the Chinese to create a fund to facilitate investment. And, you know, to what extent will these run afoul notions of WTO subsidization and so forth?
Technology here. A couple of quick questions and then maybe one that is a little more perplexing. One is, do you see any difference, Harry, between the sort of old Indian communities in Kenya and Tanzania and so forth, and new Indians coming in with DFI or trade? Secondly, is it the case as the Chinese economy begins to privatize increasingly or commercialize, let's say, and if it's the case that many of the 800 to 1,000 firms operating in Africa from China are state-owned enterprises, then as that share decreases in the Chinese economy, then we might anticipate seeing changes in behavior on the Africa side. And then the third one is, I've had some conversations with a variety of people who have made a variety who've made the following argument, that in the telecom sector and other sort of service, high-tech service areas, the Chinese have tried to break into the American market and the European market with only mixed success for services, not so much for selling white goods or, you know, that sort of stuff. And that one of the motivations in going to Africa over the long term is to learn how to penetrate markets and to gain some skills in market penetration and then eventually come back to North America and Europe. And that's provoked by what I'm told is a $2 billion investment in fiber optics and telecom in Ethiopia and Uganda. And so one of the arguments is, yes, it's to penetrate that particular market, but it's also a deliberate long-term strategy to learn market penetration stuff and tactics better than they know it now.
One last question. Do I need to use the mic?
I'm Jim Feinerman from Georgetown Law Center. I had a comment actually about your response on the corruption question, and then a couple of things. As a law professor, I guess I would consider the comment you made a little flippant, that in the United States, unlike China, there is a Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, and regardless of what you think about the effectiveness of enforcement there, it is something of a deterrent and a credible threat. Whereas for especially Chinese state-owned enterprises, it's highly unlikely the government's going to sue itself for violation of laws that it doesn't even have in existence in that regard. So, my question actually relates to some personal experiences and also how far back you go into the relationship between both China and India with Africa and communities in Africa. I was a student in China in the late 1970s, and most of the foreign students at the time were from Africa, especially not at Peking University and other elite institutions, but at places like the Railway Training Institute. And so one of the questions I have is how much do those ties still count And also, how much do China and the Indians, who I remember in large numbers in East Africa, were expelled in the mid to late 1970s in several countries, feel somewhat burned by previous experiences and may have learned or not from those in the way they make approaches now to trying to reestablish ties? I mean, are there things they can go back to, and are there also ways that they're trying to insulate themselves from possible future expropriations or expulsions, given the experiences that they had previously?
Thank you. Here, so what I suggest you do is just go ahead and wrap up on that round of questions.
Okay, good. I was being, Jim, deliberately flippant. It was deliberate. I'm quite conscious of that. I think, you know, Andrew, on this corporate social responsibility, it's very much tied to this question about reputational risk. And I mean, it's not something that we looked at directly, and really is something that I've become much more knowledgeable of as I have been disseminating this book in the last 6 weeks, spending cumulatively 4 weeks in Africa. In 14 different countries. I mean, it's clear to me from usually the organized seminars that we have. One of them is a university setting, and one of them is with government, the press, think tanks, and on the dais with me is usually the Chinese ambassador from the country and the Indian ambassador. And you know, it's again, I think, something that we just don't know that much about in terms of how serious this corporate social responsibility is coming to the fore in the thinking of the Chinese. It's much more my sense, and this is just anecdotal, much more in the forefront of the Indian typical, if one can generalize, typical Indian entrepreneur's mind. Hence, at least from our data, the fact that the Indians really want to be known as African firms and want to, in some sense, assimilate more. Now, having said that, and this is sort of apropos to this the flippant remark about corruption, I mean, you know, simply becoming more in bed with the Africans does not mean that you're going to abide by corporate social responsibility. I mean, one can make actually quite the exact opposite outcome. But I think, it's actually, it was on my, this was sort of on my list of one of the new research things I think we need to look at. The leapfrogging technology is actually tied in with Ernie's question about stepping stone to some extent. I think this is the, there's a curse and there's a blessing with development and South-South trade and investment. One of them, when you have emerging economics giants like India and China, is you're going to see Africa, the success stories are going to leapfrog seriously. And this does open up the services market. I'm actually relatively optimistic, at least for the English-speaking, the Anglophone countries vis-a-vis India. The French countries, I think, is a very different setting. But, we found, and I may have mentioned this, Tony, when we were talking before, but in Ghana there's now a thriving back office services market emerging, in fact taking away business from India. Ghana is one of the I think increasingly successful stories in Africa. And Africa is a very diverse place, but I think certainly you're going to see an emergence in the services sector in the Anglophone countries, much more so, at least initially, I think, than in the Francophone countries. And technology is clearly the missing ingredient. But one of the things the Chinese are doing very seriously, and the Indians are doing very seriously, is they do see this as extremely fertile ground where the North, the OECD investors, are not playing a bigger role. And without losing that trend of thought, I agree with you to some extent, Ernie, that this might be a stepping stone. But I also think the Chinese are sort of coming at this at a two- or three-pronged approach. I mean, they're not hesitating to try to come to North America. They're not waiting. They're not using, in some sense, Africa as a test bed. And I think, you know, and you know China well too, I mean, I think, you know, there is a sophistication among the Chinese leadership about, I hate to say that there's a grand strategy, but there's the reduced form is there's something that's going on, and I've, you know, been working in China for 15 years, and I've yet to be able to put my finger on it, but I think there's you know, there are parallel tracks that are being run. I don't think that, again, I hate to generalize, but I don't think they think of this sequentially. That's just my guess. One of the things I think that's interesting in this regard is that the Chinese, the sophisticated Chinese multinationals, particularly in the construction business, the SOEs based in different provinces, have marching orders, in quotes, as to which territory in Africa they're going to be doing business in. I mean, this was told to me explicitly many times that, you know, I'm from Sichuan, and, you know, I was told I can bid on projects in these four or five African countries, but I'm not supposed to be bidding, you know, in this part of Africa. And, you know, this is an SOE from Heilongjiang, and, you know, he's allowed to bid, you know. So there's something going on there. You know, having to put one's finger on it is very difficult. But, again, this is one of the great things about studying China is, you know, trying to peel the different layers of the onion and only find if there's another layer of the onion behind that layer. This old Indian versus new Indian actually was also on my research agenda. I think one of the things we do have data actually on the diaspora and remittances and migration. We just have not exploited that for this book, and so it's certainly what I think is one of a candidate for further research. I think, you know, this issue about China's and Africa's ties going way back, particularly this student example that you gave, is very interesting because there is, you know, an increasing, still small, but an increasing number of African countries that are really looking at, they call it the East Asian model, but, you know, particularly Ethiopia is really trying to mimic a Chinese strategy. Although the Chinese have had less of a diaspora, to be sure, in Africa than the Indians, they seem to be having much more of an influence in terms of a model, of an economic model. You know, I think built in part because they observe how India, how you know, the success story of China, but I think it's also because they do feel this kinship, and there is this simpatico, and I do think that is playing a huge role. And we try to address this a little bit in the book about what sort of can Africa learn from the East Asian miracle, to use the World Bank terminology, but I think, you know, I'm not sure that the Chinese model fits that in particular. So it's something that I suspect is going to be increasingly important, and it's also on my list of sort of the next sort of, it's sort of the feedback effects of China and India on Africa is sort of what I would also put down as sort of a research agenda. I'm sorry.
David, you
have... Sorry, I wanted to refer to a penultimate comment you made. I was wondering if you disaggregate your 450 firms and you simply focus on the Indian firms, what proportion of them are in, if you like, the old diaspora areas, like Tanzania and South Africa? Because I was wondering if you actually get a major bifurcation in attitudes, both in terms to risk investment, in terms of how eager they are to identify themselves as African rather than Indian. I would imagine that the kind of attitudes you have in Tanzania and South African firms are extremely different from Indian firms functioning in Ghana and Senegal. And that would come out if you were to disaggregate the figures.
Harry, thank you so much. One final thought on this research agenda piece. You know, my sense is that a lot of the responsibility for sorting through a bunch of these problems is going to increasingly rest within the Chinese embassies and putting an eye on sort of how they're equipping themselves and how they're thinking, because many of these issues are only going to be sorted out at the country level.
Yeah.
And it's just one of a bundle of issues that are on the horizon that they're just kind of acknowledging but not yet equipped to sort of take on. But they will quickly, I think, do that. And watching how the Chinese embassy evolves will be a very important marker of broader policy shifts, and, you know, particularly on the business reputational, the reporting back, the sort of attempt to get a political oversight or policy oversight on all of these things.
I mean, you know, it's interesting, as I mentioned in these presentations that I've done in Africa, there's always been either the ambassador or the chargé d'affaires. I mean, they're incredibly impressive about their knowledge of Africa, far more so than I suspect that you, I mean, almost by definition than you'd find in Beijing. But, I mean, the nuances that they understand and that they're willing to share, I found was just remarkable. And there's no substitute for going, to the country, in the market itself to get a much better flavor of what's going on. And I think you're quite right. And it's very clear to me that, you know, this is a major outpost. These embassies are major outposts for them.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that we heard was, you know, we observed within the Beijing policy advisory circles and think tank circles, you know, a very thin knowledge and, you know, 10 or 15 years out of date. But the counter to that was within the Foreign Service, their talent and experience is not in Beijing. It's in these embassies. They keep a fairly junior presence to do the representational stuff within Beijing, and they've operated not unlike our own system. It was a service that was somewhat set apart in career path from the rest. It was seen as one that attracted a person who was excited about this and spent their career in this, aware that there would be some certain costs.
Right.
But there was a certain there is this internal culture of Africanists within their Foreign Service. But you're going to find the most important voices within the embassies. On behalf of everybody, I just want to thank you so much.
Thank you.
This has been great.